to Betty Derrick, I'm informed that this is the 11th in the series on the sacred doctrine. And that means we've had 10 on the first volume, Cosmogenesis. And as John announced last night at Lodge, we finally are approaching Anthropogenesis. On my recent tour and parts of the section, of course, I had to take a number of planes from place to place, as is customary on such tours. And when the plane landed at Chicago, it was one of the roughest landings I've ever experienced, and it was a perfectly beautiful, calm day. And the pilot announced, "We have just attacked O'Hare Airport." And so I feel that we are just now attacking Volume 2, Anthropogenesis. For those of you who haven't been with me, the references are all to the definitive two-volume edition, which is, in essence, the original edition, the original pagination, with the editorial work, which is not extensive other than the correcting of mistakes, the modernizing of the Sanskrit, the checking of Hebrew, Greek, and other languages done by Boris de Zirkov and published at Adyar in 1978. And as you will have noted from the program, we are having only three this term because we have so many other very good things for you in this spring term, and so we could only really fit in three sessions on the secret doctrine. So during these three, what I propose to do is today give a kind of introductory which will link the cosmic processes, cosmogenesis, which of course is that in Volume 1, with what is in Volume 2, Anthropogenesis, or the evolution of mankind, and then deal more specifically with, in these two following Wednesday mornings, dealing specifically with the further three propositions which specify the fundamental principles underlying a study of anthropogenesis. Now, those of you who have stuck with me, people like Betty and Jean Sims and Virginia, and a few of you have stuck with me through this whole 10 series, which began in 1980, will realize that in our last term, when we concluded stanza 7 of Cosmogenesis, that we then looked at what I called the man pattern. That is to say, a pattern for human development, for human evolution. The overall pattern, which is, of course, a reflection of the cosmic pattern of emanational evolution. A better term than creation, because it is emanational in nature. It is an emergence which is emanational. And this is because, in essence, we live in a looking glass universe, to borrow the title of a book that I think is a very excellent overview of contemporary science in terms of contemporary physics, chemistry, biology, and psychology, The Looking Glass Universe. And we live in a looking glass universe. And if we can keep this in mind very, very clearly, that the microcosm is always a reflection of the macrocosm, the principles as they apply to the emanation of a cosmos are the same that apply to the evolution, the emanation of the human, then there is no confusion, no confusion about planetary chains, etc., etc., because it is an exact correspondence. And this is one of the fundamental principles of the esoteric philosophy, Of course, HPB enunciates it, but one finds it throughout the entire esoteric philosophy, an exact correspondence at every point. And if we can keep that principle in mind, a fundamental principle, then there is no confusion. Otherwise, you get into a lot of trouble and bewilderment. Now, the divine paradigm, then, underlying this entire process of becoming is, as I've stated on so many previous occasions, and I'll just remind you, the paradigm is known in the esoteric philosophy as the heavenly man. The struggle, of course, towards the achievement of that paradigm is what is depicted for us in Volume 2. So if we keep in mind what is the ideal, the archetype, and I'm using it in its true meaning, its Greek meaning, the archetype is the heavenly man. And everything we see in Volume 2 is then the struggle insofar as we are concerned. And what we have to do, therefore, is, if I can put it this way, seat ourselves in the universe. And that's what I propose to do today to some extent. This struggle is not always a pretty picture, incidentally, and that we have to deal with, you know, especially when we come on such evolutionary efforts, as we will be discussing here, such evolutionary efforts as the watermen, terrible and bad, the goat men, dog-headed men, and men with fish's bodies, to quote from some of the shlokas that we will be coming upon in this volume devoted to the evolution of the human being. So it's not always going to be a very pretty picture. Our evolutionary past has not necessarily, so far as the biological evolution is concerned, and so far as the efforts to bring about a suitable form for consciousness, those efforts sometimes have been, you know, failures, a little bit disastrous along the way. You know, and perhaps in some far-off, distant future, you know, when we are again together in some cosmic school, patterned after the Crotona school, naturally, we may look back on this particular period and say, that wasn't very pretty either, you know, that we may indeed be a little bit like the animals in Orwell's novel Animal Farm, in which, of course, they had a revolution, and the pig, Snowball, not Miss Piggy, but Snowball, wraps up the meaning of the revolution in a short slogan, four legs good, two legs bad. And we may look at that whole thing and say that both four legs and two legs are bad, and we have approached that marvelous ideal which Plato set forth of man as a rotundum. And I recognize that some of us are trying to achieve that in this incarnation. But that's another story. I won't insult anybody along the way. The story is a fascinating one. And I think we have to read it as a story. And by that I mean that we are going to look at it really in its metaphorical sense, and I had already used that term before Roger Jones was with us last week, because it is a story, and we have to look at it as a drama which is unfolding. That's part of its excitement. We don't know the final act, but we are now writing the fourth act, or the fifth scene of the fourth act, if you want to be exact about it. We are writing the drama as we live it. And that's part of the excitement of the whole thing, because we don't know the outcome. So, before we proceed with the story itself, or even with an overview of it, it may be helpful to suggest some references. And I'm sorry, I put them on the board simply because I didn't get time to type them out and have a nice little bibliography to hand out to you, but make you work, and you can note any of these that you want to. Naturally, the basic reference is going to be Volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine, and that's the original edition. This is Volume 3 and 4, Volumes 3 and 4 of the Adyar edition. I'm not just sure where it comes along in the abridgment, but it's there in the abridgment, of course. At least major portions of it. It begins on page 131 of the abridgment. But it will be particularly Volume 2 in the original edition, which is this nice big thick volume that we're going to be looking at, and Volume 3 of the Adyar edition. Now, in this connection, however, one has to make note of a very significant fact that I want to call to your attention right at the outset. Unlike the numbering of the shlokas, which is the word for the verses, if you like, but they are shlokas, this is a technical term. Unlike the numbering of the shlokas within the stanzas of Volume 1, here we appear to have only some portions from approximately 12 stanzas, but the shlokas are numbered consecutively. And this is a big difference, and it's going to, again, cause some confusion unless we can be, again, very clear on fundamental principles, to which I will continually call your attention until you're probably sick of hearing it. We have, in other words, a total of 49 shlokas numbered 1 through 49. Now, this is very different than the numbering in Volume 1. And even there, and this is just a reminder, those of you who were here will remember this, this is just a reminder that while we had stanza 1 in Volume 1, shlokas 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., etc., shloka 2, stanza 2, shlokas 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., and so on, through stanza 7, shlokas 1, 2, 3, and so on, you will remember that some 11 stanzas were omitted. So even the numbering cannot be followed. This is not exact. HPB, you remember, introduces us after the fourth shloka of stanza 6 in the first volume to the fact that some 11 stanzas have been omitted. So the numbering, don't worry about the numbering. This is why we need to look at principles. What is being said? People get stuck on the literalness of the numbering. And then, you know, I think this is one of the hang-ups. And I quite agree with James Hillman, the psychologist, who said literalness is sickness. You cannot get hung up on this matter. Now, this has an important bearing. And even then, HPB states that only 49 shlokas out of several hundred are given here. So we have been given bits and pieces. You know, and of course, there are always those who say, why aren't we given more? And how about who's going to come along and give us the rest and so on? Well, I think we don't need any more or deserve any more until we understand what we've been given. And we're, you know, this is part of our struggle. And then she says, not every verse is translated verbatim. A periphrasis is sometimes used for the sake of clearness and intelligibility, where a literal translation would be quite unintelligible. This is page 15 of Volume 2, in case you like to check up on me. Now, a further point must be noted, and that is that the story related in these 49 shlokas refers only to our earth in its fourth round. And so we need to review briefly, at least, the teachings that have been given in regard to what are known as the planetary chains. And let me interject at once that that, again, along with the term root races, is a most unfortunate term, because it has led to endless confusion as to the planets. Actually, what is intended, and it is very, very clear indeed, in one of the letters to A.P. Sinnett, that mistakes arising from confusion of terms that I, that is the Master, had to learn from you, since it is you, that is Mr. Sinnett, who were the author of these English terms, rounds, rings, etc. And that is where the misunderstanding fundamentally lies. It should never really have been called a planetary chain. And that's why we get mixed up with planets in our solar system with planets in terms of the whole evolutionary system in which we are engaged, any more than it should have been called races, which now gets applied in a pejorative sense to ethnic groups. And here again, one has to be very careful and simply remember two fundamental facts. First of all, it is very clear that these English terms were translations of terms known in the secret schools in which HPB was educated, trained in Tibet. And the Master himself, in one of the Mahatma letters, says, our terms are nearly untranslatable. And HPB indicates this further by saying, for a literal translation would be quite unintelligible. She has paraphrased the shloka for the sake of a clearness and intelligibility. But she had to use the language of her day, as indeed did Mr. Sinnett in suggesting the term. So please, this, if you can keep this in mind, this will clarify a very great deal of the subsequent confusion in our later literature, because what we are looking at is fundamental principles. And it is as wrong to speak of a planetary chain in its literal sense of the planets of our solar system as it is to speak of root races in terms of ethnic groups. And this is made amply clear if one comes to fundamental principles. I feel very strongly on this because we have tended to become literal in the use of these terms. And then we get into arguments and confusion and so on. And there is no argument necessary if you go to the meaning of what is being given to us, you see, and if you go back to fundamental principles. Then it all falls into place beautifully. Well, we'll come back to this in a moment. Now, one of the finest expositions, I think, of the entire subject of anthropogenesis, because it interprets this subject from the point of view of its metaphorical or symbolic meaning for us in our present situation, is that work which follows on the one I used so much in the previous series, Man, the Measure of All Things, you remember, by Sri Krishna Prem and Sri Madhava Ashish. Because of the untimely death of Sri Krishna Prem, although he had indeed worked out the outline for the commentary on these second set of stanzas and the shlokas therein, and he had worked out in general much that was to be part of that commentary, the book was finally put together by his collaborator and his student and co-worker, Sri Madhava Ashish, and it bears only his name, therefore, Man, Son of Man. And I highly recommend this. I think it is an outstanding book. One has to watch, however, that Ashish has rearranged the slokas, and I think has personally, from my own studies, he has done a very good job. In fact, I think it makes better sense the manner in which he has put them for our purposes. So you have to watch that. I shall be referring to this very often, man, son of man. And as he says, and let me just quote, and this is really why I refer to it, he says, we have to keep in mind that the real significance and purpose of these stanzas, or that of any other account of the universal Genesis for that matter, is not in their apparent concern with historical, geological, or anthropological events, but lies in their being a symbolic account of psychic movements within us as living men. Now, that's not psychic events, but movements within the psyche. That is within consciousness itself. And so he says, the stanzas are concerned with man, and all the stones, waters, mothers, and fathers are glyphs of the patterns of our inner and outer being woven by the powers of life. The comments are intended to present the stanzas in a light that may make them of use to those few who seek an intelligent means of relating inner value to outer experience. Now, it's because I think we have to begin to recognize that we are not therefore dealing purely with historical events, but with myth, which is the true history of the soul. And so it really doesn't matter the historicity to some extent. What matters is what happens in terms of consciousness, because this is our focus, and we will identify this. But we cannot overlook what many students regard as the factual aspect of the teaching, although even fact, I think, has to be considered as metaphor, since any description of historical events is still not the event itself. It's a description of the event, isn't it? You see. But I, therefore, for those who like to feel some solid ground under them, in a sense, I will draw heavily on the very excellent work done by Jeffrey Barborka, who was, I think, one of the finest students of the secret doctrine. And, of course, Jeffrey had given classes on the secret doctrine here at the Crotona School in years past. A very fine student. And his several works in explanation of man's origins and development are very helpful in understanding what I can only call the technical side of the doctrines. First and foremost, of course, The Divine Plan. I think it's one of the finest books we've ever had. I think it's an outstanding work in explication of the secret doctrine. And then his two further works that deal more specifically with anthropogenesis, The Peopling of the Earth and The Story of Human Evolution. These are, although this is The Peopling of the Earth, not a terribly big book, and The Story of Human Evolution is also not a terribly big book. So those I certainly recommend. Now, Elizabeth Preston was also one of our very finest students, and she, of course, did much of the work on the abridgment of the secret doctrine. Really quite an outstanding person in herself, I think a very delightful person. I will always remember my first visit to Adyar having tea with Elizabeth Preston on her balcony in River Bungalow, and the delightful person that Elizabeth Preston was. I expect Joan must have known her, and perhaps others here had met her. Absolutely delightful, and she was a deep student, and a very fine student. I had very nice discussions on that occasion, my first visit out to Adyar and meeting her, many fine discussions with her on the very fact that we have to be alert to contemporary language. And she was one who fully supported an effort that was then being made by those of us responsible for the first production of some of the Quest books, in recognizing that certain terms now were pejorative. And, for example, the very use of the term savage, which HPB uses, yes. UNESCO has requested that it not be used. Rather, the term primitive has been substituted, and so on. So that one has to be very careful in this whole matter of language. And one of the delightful discussions with Elizabeth Preston was over this very matter, and her strong feeling, because she was trained in the sciences, that one has to look very closely at the words that are being used today and recognize that even when HPB wrote, certainly, and through some of the other literature, language has been used which was consistent with the thought patterns of the time, but may not be appropriate in contemporary settings. This does not mean the ideas are not valid, but rather that one has to look at the language. In any event, her books, which are very, very useful, she has two, one The Story of Creation and the other The Story of Man, which are just little paperback books. I've happened to have them bound together. The Story of Man, according to the Secret Doctrine, of course, deals with the whole subject of anthropogenesis. Earth and its cycles and life and its spirals are also still very excellent books, but again, one has to be very careful. These were brought out, one over 30 years ago and the other over 20 years ago, and much advance has been made in geological studies and anthropological studies. So do not take the dates given as the most contemporary, because there are constant efforts in both the fields of geology and anthropology to date the age of the earth and the age of some of the earliest hominids or human forms, human-like forms, to which the name hominid has been now given. There is a constant reappraisal of this, so one has to be very cautious in taking a chart even of 30 years ago so far as the dating of geological strata on the Earth's surface is concerned. One has to be very careful on that. But the principles are there, and they're very good. That's why I continually call your attention to principles. A very interesting book that came out in the 1930s, and I think has a great deal of value, and mine is falling to pieces, and as you can see, and the front and back covers are missing and all the rest, is a very interesting little book, The Evolution of Man, by one of the leading members then of the French section, Émile Marcot, and a member from Poland who settled in England, Havlicek, Ivan Havlicek. And this is a very, I'm not sure that it's at all still in print. It was brought out by the Theosophical Research Center in London, The Evolution of Man, but you may come across it in libraries. A more recent work, which has been brought out, which I think has a great deal of value, by one of the finest students of the Point Loma tradition, Elsie Benjamin, a marvelous person whose death a year or so ago ended a tremendous career in Theosophical studies, is Man at Home in the Universe, a Study of the Great Evolutionary Cycle. It's a very fine book. I would think if this is not available in the bookstore, it can easily be made available. And then a work by, I think, one of the finest students we have ever had in the Adyar Society, E.L. Gardner, quite an outstanding student. Again, I had the privilege of meeting him only when he was up in his late 90s, I think. Joan must have known him much earlier, of course. Jack, I expect you'd met him. Maybe others, Janet, must have met him. A marvelous person. And his particular work that deals with this that is helpful is a pamphlet called Whence Come the Gods. And this was brought out, it was the Blavatsky Lecture in 1959 in England. And So I'm not sure if it's in print still, but it's, if you may come across it, it certainly is a very helpful work on this. So much for then some of the references, so that you can do a lot of your own study. Well, needless to say, there's also a great deal of information on various aspects of the subject of man's origins and his present position in the Mahatma letters. And I haven't put that here, but that certainly is a fundamental reference, the Mahatma letters, as well as, of course, in many other writings of HPB. And incidentally, in that connection, and thinking of her other writings, there's a very interesting statement in the Key to Theosophy, which has always rather intrigued me and indeed rather amused me, not because HPB intended any humor in it, but because I certainly doubt its accuracy, if I can put it that way. You may say, ha, she doubts something that HPB wrote. Well, oh, why shouldn't we? But I think I doubt its accuracy simply because of the way she puts it. In talking about some of the misconceptions that arise in the inquirer's mind concerning the society, HPB states, the first thing which the members learn, this is where I got amused, you see, because I'd like to know of the members here if this was the first thing you learned, you see. She says, the first thing which the members learn is a true conception of the relation of the body or physical sheath to the inner, the true man. Now, I rather doubt, that's why I smile over that, because somehow I rather doubt that that is accurate. I think that most of us did not learn that as the first thing that we learned about the theosophical worldview. We probably learned about reincarnation or karma or something else, you know. Heaven only knows what. But anyway, according to HPB, that's the first thing which members learn. Well, that's by the way. Now, to take up the study of anthropogenesis, we have first, then, I suggest, to recognize that this study has a profound relevance to our current situation, to where we are. If you felt through the series on cosmogenesis that we were talking about matters far beyond our personal concerns in living in the world, our personal destiny, or what should be our unique dharma in the present situation, now you should be satisfied, because here we are talking about things that are directly relevant. And for that, it means we have to, as I say, place ourselves in the universe. We have to know where we stand. Where are we in terms of the total pattern of the evolution of a system? And I think that this is, it does have a profound relevance. One writer, a paleoanthropologist of today, Matt Cartmill, has put it this way: what we think about our place in the universe affects what we are prepared to believe about human origins. How we got here may not tell us anything about what we are, but it has a lot to do with what we think about ourselves and our place in the universe. And I think this is very, very true. Sri Madhava Ashish has really stated the same thing, in saying that what we believe about our origin determines what we believe about our destiny. And both of these determine our attitude towards everyday life. I think we may not realize the extent to which this is really true. You can say it really doesn't matter, all of these so-called rounds and chains and races, etc., etc., you see. What does this matter? It doesn't really matter how much time there is left or what we go through and all the rest of it. It does matter supremely because it governs our attitude immediately now, how we react to events, how we look at ourselves, and more importantly, how we look at others, how we view others in this whole chain of existence, this oneness, which includes interrelationship and interdependence, as Jack Patterson pointed out in his series yesterday, beginning his series yesterday. I think it has a profound effect. I have often spoken, you recall, on other occasions, of the fact that in the study of the secret doctrine, we have to recognize another mode of thinking than the traditional mode in which we in the West have been accustomed. We have been trained, we have been so trained in a mode of thinking, which we call a Western mode, which is a scientific mode, if you like, that it is very difficult for us to recognize that there are other modes of thinking. This was brought sharply to my attention during a workshop which I gave at our national headquarters just a couple of weekends ago when I was there, in which I was talking about and encouraging their study of the septenate nature of the human being. And I was referring in that to what I feel is one of the most remarkable statements in the Mahatma letters. It's in letter 16, not chronologically, but in the printed order in the book, in which the Mahatma K.H. advises Mr. Sinnott to study as thoroughly as you can the twin doctrines of karma and nirvana. And so I was referring to that because both karma and nirvana are, in essence, processes, and I was attempting to explain at least how I look at that. The master goes on by saying that these are two of the seven concepts of the Buddhist metaphysics, which are absolutely essential for understanding the entire system. And one of the participants in that workshop, a young man, said to me, "What lies beyond nirvana?" And I jumped on him, knowing him well enough that I could jump on him, and said, "That is a typically Western mind question, because it sees nirvana as a kind of destination where one gets off the train of karma, as it were, you see. One disembarks from this train in which one has been sort of held in bondage, glued in to the jerking of the train, which we think of as karma. One disembarks and, ha, one has arrived at a station that's marked nirvana, you see. And this is very typical of a Western mind. We want to know are there further stations down the line? What if I get back on this train? Will I get somewhere else, you see?" And so he immediately, said, well, he realized that the question was a wrong question, that nirvana is not a station at which one disembarks after a certain number of lives or after going through an amount of meditation or anything else. It is a consciousness, a condition of consciousness in which one still lives here if necessary. One still lives in the world because there is no difference between the world of phenomenal affairs and nirvana as a way or a consciousness which perceives the entire manifested realm in a new light. Nothing has changed. Absolutely nothing has changed except one's perception, except one's consciousness. And that, of course, is the major change. And when that has occurred, you see, it is a change. It's the condition of being Buddha, to be awake. And one is either asleep or one is awake. And one doesn't say, well, what comes after I wake up? If you're awake, you're awake. You are simply, fully, completely awake. So I have pointed this out again and again, that what we believe, therefore, and our mode of thinking has very much influenced everything in the way we look at ourselves, look at the world, look at each other. And certainly, therefore, what we believe about our own origins. How did we get a physical body? You see? And that's volume two. You see? What is the whole progress? This, what we believe about our destiny, these determine our attitudes every single moment. You know, this is the great dharma of it. So what we believe also about the nature of the universe itself, or at least about the nature of universal processes, determines to a very great extent how we view ourselves, and to what extent we assign significance to the human state, as well as, indeed, it determines the entire ethos that we adopt. This is what makes a true theosophist, is the ethos we adopt as a result of what we know about universal processes and about our own origins and destiny. So I think that HPB was quite right in first presenting us with the tremendous and awe-inspiring panorama of cosmogenesis before she introduced us to the details of man's own evolutionary development as part of, but a central part of, that vast panorama of cosmic process. Because with the entrance of man on the stage, the whole process now becomes reflective, self-conscious, if you like. The mirror principle is present now, knowingly, in terms of consciousness. It was always there, always present. Now it is made self-conscious. And even the paleoanthropologists, that's an awful term, you know, it's a terrific science, paleoanthropology, isn't that marvelous? Admit that there is evidence for the fact that the star actor has been off stage for 99.99% of the cosmic play so far. But the secret doctrine, admitting very much in one sense this same thing, we have been in the wings for 99.99% of the cosmic process. But that does not mean that the entrance of the star actor on the stage is an insignificant event. In fact, this entrance changes the entire drama. There, from that point on, the play has a new plot, if you like. The drama now comes alive in a marvelous way. It's certainly the secret doctrine neither assigns to him an insignificant role, nor does it consign him to meaninglessness. In fact, it is only man as we know him, the star actor in this fourth globe of a fourth round that has been off stage so long. The archetype, and this is the important thing in this great cosmic drama, the archetype, the divine paradigm, if you like, has always been present from the beginning of the cosmic process. HPB makes this very clear, volume 1, page 183. I like to give you references, as you know, so you can always check up on anything I say and determine if you interpret it differently, which is fine. HPB points out that every form on earth and every speck in space strives in its efforts towards self-formation to follow the model placed for it in the... Get into the actual study with these three very significant propositions, which I really won't take up until next week. I think it may help if we remind ourselves of the general principles which govern the emergence of a manifested system. Now, I'm using, therefore, a diagram from Ashish, Man, Son of Man. So if you have the book, Man, Son of Man, you don't need to worry about the diagram because it is there. But it just helps as a kind of quick review. In the undifferentiated darkness, of the absolute, we can suggest that a search begins. Now, even those words are wrong, I admit, but there's no language, there's no vocabulary for expressing this cyclicity which is present, which is part, of course, of the second fundamental proposition, the law, universal law of periodicity. But that universal law of periodicity indicates that even within the undifferentiated and undiscriminated darkness of the absolute, there is a movement. And this is certainly present in Shloka 1 of Stanza 1. The eternal parent slumbered once again for 7 eternities. There is some movement. And we can suggest, therefore, the nearest we can come to it is that a search begins for knowledge of itself. A search whose dynamism has been called love-desire. A dynamism, you'll recall, which is my favorite character. I'm sure all of you know what I'm going to say. Fohat. That this is the dynamism, and it is a love-desire, because HPB clearly equates Fohat and Eros. You see, that we're not going to go back over there. Don't worry. I won't, you know, go back over things we've discussed. But this desire cannot be fulfilled, nor the knowledge made explicit, until the inherent qualities of being are caused to become objective to the perceptive powers of awareness. This is Dr. Bohm's implicate and explicate orders, if you like. This is an unrolling, if you like. This is the emanation. And so, of course, one can ask how in the undifferentiated absolute even such a quality as searching may arise. Yet by the very nature of being, or be-ness, to use HPB's own term, there is inherent within the non-differentiated nature of the source all that will eventually be differentiated, all, in other words, that will be manifest to objective perception. And so there is, as it were, first of all, a focusing, which we can call parabrahm if you like, that focusing of being's own nature is the only way we can express it, a focusing of being's own nature, a concentration of light, to use another metaphor, and then a bursting forth of the countless sparks, each one carrying in potentiality all the qualities of the one flame. Each spark, in other words, a hologram revealing the presence of the whole, if you want to put it in contemporary terms. And that, then, is the differentiation into subjective and objective poles, where actually the perceiver is the perceived, but we draw it apart for purposes of looking at it a little more easily. But each of the sparks, then, as it were, is surrounded by a field of energy appropriate to its nature and reveals its own development through what we now call the successive fields of experience. The literature often refers to these as the planes, but they are fields of experience in terms of the sparks or conscious entities, monads if you prefer. I'm not going to go back over all of that. There is, of course, you remember in one of the past series, I did a whole study on the monad and its meaning. And each then is an energy field increasing in objectivity because it gives birth to the universal mind, Maha, and the modes in which that mind operates, which is the lower quaternary, if you like. So this, again, we can see this, each increasing in objectivity until for our system, the physical is developed. As Ashish puts it, in the struggle towards ever greater self-expression, the human body is evolved as a vehicle not only of the sense perception common to all animal forms, but also, and most importantly, of the powers of understanding through which the divine self-nature can eventually achieve the fulfillment of its search. This is the purpose of evolution. The divine self-nature achieves the fulfillment in self-conscious terms. It is now fully self-conscious. So to place all of this development with its subsequent unfolding of consciousness through the human stage as we know it, we have to look just very briefly at least to the whole cycle in which we operate. You know, it's interesting, just in this March issue of the Smithsonian, there is an excellent article that, again, a new field of study that is opening up, which is known as cognitive ethology, very interesting, and suggesting that animals are indeed conscious beings, admitting this, you see, which is very interesting, that even primates can lie, in other words, they can tell falsehoods, and bees can think, and so on, that there is indeed this, but in man, this consciousness becomes understanding, so that there is another factor added to it, which we've already gone into in one sense in terms of the descent of the incarnation of the Manasaputras. I won't go back over that. All part of this total picture, you see. Now, we have then to recognize, first of all, one of the fundamental principles of the occult philosophy. The secret doctrine teaches the progressive development of everything, worlds as well as atoms, and this stupendous development has neither conceivable beginning nor imaginable end. It's volume 1, page 43. One of the fundamental principles, a progressive development of everything. And HPB further states, volume 1, page 277 and 78, the whole order of nature evinces a progressive march towards a higher life. The very fact that adaptations do occur, that the fittest do survive in the struggle for existence, shows that what is called unconscious nature is in reality an aggregate of forces manipulated by semi-intelligent beings, elementals, guided by high planetary spirits, the Anchohans, whose collective aggregate forms the manifested verbum of the unmanifested logos. All of this, then, is the spoken word. It is the word made flesh, if you like. The universe and we in it, whose collective aggregate forms the manifested verbum of the unmanifested logos and constitutes at one and the same time the mind of the universe and its immutable law. Because it is through mind that law arises. Law by the action of Fohat. We won't go back into that. That's all very clear in the first volume. I know that you want me to really get on to the second volume, but we have to keep these things in mind. So we can't give in detail the entire teaching concerning the planetary chains and rounds, even if we were capable of understanding all its complexities. And you remember that when we were discussing stanza 6, I devoted an entire session to the doctrine of planetary chains and rounds. So anyone that wants to hear the tape can listen to the tape even. What we need to remember is that we here, as man, contemporary man, in this present embodiment, are stepping into the middle of the entire process. In fact, HPB tells us in Volume 1, I've already mentioned that of the 11 stanzas she omitted, one is devoted to a full description of the formation of the planetary chains one after another. And then she speaks of the countless circular chains of worlds composed of seven globes graduated on the four lower planes of the world of formation. The four lower planes of the world of formation. So we have the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh cosmic planes. She's very clear about this. The countless circular chains of worlds composed of seven globes, and this comes back to a fundamental principle, the principle of the septenate, which is one of the fundamental principles, you'll remember, in the occult philosophy, graduated on the four lower planes of the world of formation. And that is indeed this world of formation, the modes of universal mind. And she adds, the three others belonging to the archetypal universe. So in a sense, above this, you see, the third, the second, and the first, 3, 2, 1, and therefore can be completed indeed as the Pythagorean decad is, or the Sephirothal tree in the Kabbalah is. Because both of these, you see, 10 then becomes the perfect number. That's very clear also in, you know, the Pythagorean system, in the Kabbalah, and so on, all of that. And so she says, every such chain of worlds is the progeny and creation of another, lower and dead chain. For us, that was the moon chain. We'll go back, we can look at that, although I don't want to take too much time on it. But we'll come to it when we come to the formation of the model for the physical body, which was that model provided by what are known as the lunar petries or the Barhashads. We've already spoken of this to some extent, but we'll look at it again. So don't worry. We can't do everything one morning. You know, there are going to be two more mornings. But every such chain of worlds is the progeny and creation of another lower and dead chain, its reincarnation, so to say. Now, the principle here, then, is what is important. Following the septenary principle, each chain of globes is septenate and corresponds with the septenate nature of man, as HPB makes very, very clear in a diagram which is on page 153 of Volume 1. She has, indeed, the human principles and the planetary division. And that's an extremely important diagram to note because it makes very, very clear what we are talking about. There can no more be three physical planets than there are three physical bodies of man. It will not work if the principle is there. It simply will not work, do you see? You don't have three physical bodies, you have one physical body. And it simply will not work in any other way. And E.O. Gardner, in Whence Come the Gods, makes very clear how some of the confusion arose. Because there is, indeed, a direct influence on the human hierarchy from both Mars and Mercury, as well as Venus, the Venusian system. Very clear. So if you get away from calling it planetary, you see, which is the whole problem as it has arisen, as well as race, if you see these as spheres in which, and we'll come to that in just a moment in terms of the diagram that you have, And you recognize most of the time it's put this way, in this nice ladder sort of formation, just like the planes of man's principles are put, you know, in a layer cake sort of thing. The icing in between is kama and buddhi. You see, that's the sweetening for these hard, overbaked principles of manas and physical sort of thing. But here it is again. And HVB is very clear that 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th cosmic planes, these are the formation planes, the formative. This is the quaternary in terms of the system, the cosmos, in which this development is taking place. And the top three, as she says, are the archetypal. Always, again, a universal principle. The three reflected into the four. The three fall into the four. And every mason ought to know that, because it's symbolized in his apron. There it is. Always. And it's in every tradition. So we have then these globes. And that was the first term that was used, if I remember correctly. George, Virginia can correct me, but I think in the Mahatma letters, the first term that was used was globes, not planets. I think that's true. And this, if it had been kept that, it might have been a little clearer for us, rather than planets. So, the analogy holds, as the physical body is the upadhi of all the six inner principles of man, so there is but one material or outermost globe in our chain, which is the upadhi of the six invisible to us. Upadhi meaning that which nourishes, holds, and is the vehicle for. Now this is very, very important. And it's further clarified in Jeffrey Barborka's Peopling of the Earth. He has two diagrams in that, one on page 55, which helps to clarify it, and one on page 124. And he relates these also to the seven sacred planets, which again are very, very important, and we'll go into that. But what I want now to bring out very clearly is the point that is made by HPB, and which E.L. Gardner has given a diagrammatic representation of. So on the page you have before you, if you want to indicate that this comes from the booklet Whence Come the Gods by E.L. Gardner. That's the source of it, just so you'll know its source. And HPB is very clear on this point, which is a rather interesting one, and that is simply, as I've quoted on the board here, and is on page 166 of volume 1 in her discussion of this doctrine of the planetary chains. She's very clear on it. This is indeed not her own writing, but this is an answer given by the Mahatma himself. And she states this. It's an extract, verbatim extracts, from a letter, which is not in the Mahatma letters, so far as I can discover. I may be incorrect on that, but I have not seen it there. And she says, she's quoting directly. This is an answer, she says. Our globe, as taught from the first, is at the bottom of the arc of descent, where the matter of our perceptions exhibits itself in its grossest form. Hence it only stands to reason that the globes which overshadow our earth must be on different and superior planes. In short, as globes, They are in coadjunation, but not in consubstantiality with our earth. And this, I think, is something that many students have simply overlooked, because it's a very clear statement. These other globes are in coadjunation.
What's that mean?
I'll come to that. But not in consubstantiality. Now, what does that mean? With our earth, and thus pertain to quite another state of consciousness. The word coadjunation comes from, of course, the Latin co or con, with, and adunare, which means unare, one, ad, to one, joining together to be one. Now, this diagram which you have there, as you will see, the one on the right-hand side of your page says the seven globes of our planetary chain with a common center in coadjunition. Coadjunation, it should be. In HBB, it's an A there, coadjunation. I think that may be a misprint because I looked it up in the dictionary. And there you will see that actually, while it may be said that we move in the rounds from one globe to another, they are all present here, but they are of different, not in consubstantiality, they are of different substances. And just as you, now sitting here, do not have off somewhere else an astral vehicle and somewhere else a mental vehicle, and maybe you're left the buddhic vehicle at home today or something else, you are in coadjunation of all your principles right here. But they are not of consubstantiality. That is, we say that the astral, the karmic, the manasic, and the buddhic are of a different substance, don't we? A finer substance than this gross material. Isn't that right? Is that clear? But your emotions are as much here as your physical body is here. Your mind, I hope, is here. You are as one, you see. And this is what she is pointing to. And this point has been left out. I have not seen it except in Gardner emphasized. And it makes it so very clear, doesn't it? And the law of correspondences or law of analogy holds exactly. The principle is there. Do you see how it removes all of these other problems? And this is the key to it, and this is in the Secret Doctrine, HBB quoting a letter from one of the adept teachers. And it's very easy then. Now, we put it in this way, and HBB herself puts it in this way, but I prefer this diagram of E.L. Gardner's. I think it's a marvelous one. And the one on the left-hand side, you see, takes up a very interesting proposal, and that is really deals with the problem, as he says, in Euclidean geometry to describe an equilateral triangle upon a finite straight line and so on. And we have what is one of the great classical symbols of generation and creative life known as the Vesica Pisces. It's a marvelous symbol which is used. It's a very well-known symbol in the Christian tradition, and here it gives it to you, this symbolic representation of this entire chain. But the chief one that I wanted you to look at is the one on the figure 5, which I've given you, because I think it shows so very clearly that we stand in the middle. But all of the others are present right now. And there is, again, a vesica between them, as he points out, A to G and B to F. And this shows the interconnection of man's own principles. It's a marvelous suggestion, and I think... Now, one further point. As I've just suggested, we are stepping into the middle of the process. It is said that this earth chain is the fourth in our particular cosmos, although it is also pointed out that there are numerous chains. That is to say, in this system of periodicity, there must be, but for our system, it is said this is the fourth. What is more, and it's said, therefore, that our particular life wave came from the moon chain. We're not going to go into all of that. We've touched on it before, and you can study it. I've given you the references. You can study it. Each chain consists of seven globes, and the evolution of life proceeds on these seven globes from the first to the seventh. And you see, from A, B, C, D, D being the earth, through E, F, and G, and these are slightly higher. That should not be a straight line, because these are, of course, subplanes in there. And so each one is slightly higher, and we stand alone. Man is great, the great orphan. You remember that. We stand alone. This is the tremendous responsibility. It is what is pointed to in the third fundamental proposition, that we have to do it by self-devised and self-directed effort throughout a long series of reincarnations and metempsychoses. We've gone into that too, so I won't bore you with that all over again. We stand alone. But it is said that we move through this entire cycle seven times, and we have been through it 3 1/2, so that we are now in the fourth round. If anything could be plunk in the middle, that's it. And the fourth round, and here, take care, within each of these rounds, each time we have been back here, there are seven developmental stages of consciousness referred to as the root races. They are not ethnic groups. They are major developmental stages. You see, absolutely developmental stages. Barborka uses that term, and I think it's a very good term to keep in mind.
And just on globe D?
Just on globe D, though each one of them will have the same, in that sense, you see. So this is the next point, that from the first to the seventh, in seven rounds or seven cycles, and then seven major stages must be passed through on each of these, on this present globe, therefore, which we know as the Earth, and hence the name given to the entire chain is called the Earth chain, because it's the densest, seven major stages in the development of consciousness must be passed through. Stages we have called the root races. And here it is said that we are in the fifth developmental stage. So we're a little bit past halfway, because 3 1/2 rounds, and now in the fourth, but in the fifth developmental stage. Now, what does this mean? Often it is said that the focus is entirely on manas. Here again, let's be very clear. It is the manasic aspect of the fourth principle which is dominant in the fourth round, and that is kama, K-A-M-A. So this is the principle that is dominant for this round is the perfecting of the comic or desire principle. And I'm avoiding the word astral because when HPB uses it, often it refers to the etheric, and so we have to be very careful. So if you use these Sanskrit terms, you're a little bit closer to what is being intended. The comic principle, so that again, by the law of correspondences, that's why I'm emphasizing this, keep this in mind, within each of these principles are all of the other principles. You may remember we studied something about the tattvas way back, you remember, and we pointed out that in each of these there is a dominant one, but all of the others are present, what we call often the subplanes of the planes, if that's easier for you to see it in that way.
So,
now the fourth principle in man's development is kama. Atma, buddhi, manas, kama, which is the desire principle. So the fourth always, and we are in the fifth, so it is the manasic principle of kama. Now, if you think the mind is rigid now, just wait till we get to the manasic principle of manas in the fifth round, in the fifth root race, if you like, fifth developmental stage. This is why our real problem, and this is what HPB pointed to, knowing very clearly where we stand and what is our responsibility, that we have an opportunity, which is the greatest of all challenges, to leap ahead. Now, it is said in the literature that there can only be one major phase ahead, except for the Buddha, who went two stages ahead, the first of our humanity to achieve that great enlightenment. You see? You remember that? You see? But we can leap ahead, and our function, it has been said, is to change kama manas to buddhi manas, which is to leap ahead. We can use manas as a platform then to disentangle from the comic element and therefore become what we were intended to become, and which is pointed to in volume one, that the elect of our humanity, and you know, that is self-elected, not because we're superior beings, but because this is the knowledge that has been given to us. And why was it given to us? Well, we can go into that. I could lecture for an hour on why this was given to us. It seems to me very clear why it was given to us, to meet this tremendous challenge of the present day, the 20th century, the most glorious incarnation in all of our incarnations, because it's the one of greatest opportunity and greatest challenge.
And danger.
And the risk is always there. But the challenge is to now, because we are at that fifth developmental stage of manas, still within the whole aura of the comic principle, the fourth round, that we can use that as a platform to leap ahead and become, if we will, the great elect of humanity, the teachers and guides. This is the knowledge that has been given to us. And how many just throw it away and do nothing with it? This is the ethos, the fundamental ethic, to become a bodhisattva. This is why her last great work was The Voice of the Silence, which showed very clearly the bodhisattva path, to live not for oneself but for others, to use this knowledge. This is where we are. And all of Volume 2 is devoted, therefore, to this situation, what the great Buddhist teacher Tsongkhapa called our present unique condition. Marvelous, isn't it? In this whole cycle, here is this vast panorama, and here we are, in the fifth developmental stage, on the fourth round, on this particular chain of globes, which is all present. You're not going to go anywhere. If you look at the diagram of E.L. Gardner, it's all of these globes are right here, just as all of your principles are right here. The principles have to be awakened.
I don't want to get off on something else.
That's all right. It's probably time I got off on something else.
Responsibility is that we are now creating the mineral forms which will be used by the life that is presently in the mineral kingdom.
That's right, yes.
So what mineral forms we create will be used by humanity aeons
hence. That's right. We are now creating the mental structures for what is now in the mineral kingdom. And this accounts, as HPB says, this accounts for the great variations in humanity, the great differences in humanity. And it's not in the sense of racial, of ethnic differences. It's in a sense that there have been, as we've gone into, various classes of monads, you see, that have taken incarnation. There have been successive life waves. You see, and this she is very clear about, that indeed there have been and there are these great differences in humanity. But why? You see, knowledge is power. This was, of course, I think, one of the reasons, because it has been abused by a lot of the other groups and, you know, by people and so on, will always be abused. Why perhaps there was this discussion in the hierarchy of our adept brothers as to whether it was wise to share this information which had always been kept in the secret schools, which was always known in the mystery schools, to make it public. But those, you know, this is why it is the secret doctrine. Because it will always remain secret to those who do not really awaken to its profound meaning and the responsibility, therefore, that we have as heirs to this tradition. It should make us not at all feel superior, because we're not, but it should make us feel responsible, which we are. Anyway, that's where we are. Take it or leave it, that's where you are.
Make the best of it,
you see.
No, I'm going to dumb and literally.
That's very good, Diana. Your questions are never dumb.
How many principles are there? Are they linked in with the rounds or with the developmental stages of the
both? Both. So there is an exact correspondence. And this is where it very much helps. You see, any of the diagrams of the principles of man must be seen as a metaphor. It is only a description of reality. It is not reality itself. It's merely a description in which we order our experiences. And this is why, incidentally, why HBB says that the principles are numbered differently for every individual, which doesn't make sense unless you see them, indeed, as descriptions, not reality in itself, you see. That's where you have to be very careful. But there is an exact correspondence between the principles, between the development of the earth. Remember, we went into that the earth itself develops pari passu with man. And it's only in this fourth round, therefore, as it is said, that it hardens and settles. Because this is the action, in a sense, of the monastic principle on kama, which gets it into rigid structures. Before that, it has been fluidic, you see. So there's an exact correspondence, the principles of man, the development of the planet itself, the rounds on the planet and the chains of globes in their entire cycle all stand in exact correspondence. Isn't it a beautiful system? Inherently, you know, today contemporary science is testing any particular theory by what one scientist has said, its elegance, its beauty, and its simplicity. Now, I defy anyone to come up with a more beautiful, more elegant, and essentially simple theory, postulate, than the theosophical worldview. You cannot do it.
The simplicity lies in the correspondence.
The simplicity lies in keeping in mind these fundamental principles, and fundamentally the principle of correspondence, or analogy, if you prefer. Virginia's favorite quotation, the law of analogy, is the Ariadne thread which will guide the student unerringly through all the mazes of nature. Did I get it right? So there it is. Elegant. Is there anything more elegant than this system, which points directly to human responsibility, the ethos which is required of us, and beautiful because every part fits perfectly. So it meets every test of scientific theory, you see, and points beyond. But if that's, it's interesting that great scientists are saying this today. Now, this admits of paradox, of course. There are a lot of paradoxes. And you'll remember that I've repeatedly stated that to read The Secret Doctrine, you have to become accustomed to thinking in terms of paradox, metaphor, and ambiguity. That's not easy for us. And yet this is precisely what contemporary physics is telling us. You remember I've often quoted that marvelous statement of Niels Bohr. The opposite of a great truth is not necessarily a falsehood. The opposite of a great truth is another great truth. This, you see, is we have to become accustomed to it, because language, by its very nature, by the very nature of language, language reflects consciousness. Therefore, by its very nature, reflects the stage of consciousness in these developmental stages. And so it must resort to paradox.
You remember that Dr. Jones said last week that everything at the manifested level is a paradox.
Everything is a paradox.
It contains a paradox,
yes. And it is descriptive of reality, it is not reality itself. And what we are dealing with are descriptions, therefore they are metaphors. And so every diagram, and this, you know, once you see this, you don't argue really over whether we should number the principles, you know, in one way, lower and higher mind as two principles, which of course is nonsense because we have one mind. It functions in two directions. But you see, it really doesn't matter because they are metaphors of experience. They are descriptions of reality, not reality itself. They are ordering principles within us. They order our experience far more than they even describe reality. So, yes.